In this episode of UIndy's Potluck Podcast, where we host conversations about the arts, English 478 students, Destiny Guidry, Aliyah Hughes, and Ethan Thurston interview poet Aaron Ballou, a guest of the Kellogg Writers Series, which is a series that brings writers of distinction to the University of Indianapolis campus for classroom discussions and free public readings. Born in Nebraska, Aaron Ballou earned an MA from Boston University and an MFA from The Ohio State University. Ballou's work focuses on gender, love, and history, filtering wide-ranging subject matter through a variety of theoretical frameworks. She often addresses feminist issues and uses poetic conventions and street talk. Ballou is the award-winning author of many books of poetry, including Come Hither, Honeycomb, Slant Six, Black Box, One Above, One Below. She also co-edited with Susan Eisenberg the anthology The Extraordinary Tide, New Poetry by American Women. We hope you enjoy this episode of UIndy's Potluck Podcast.
Hello, book lovers. Welcome to the UIndy Potluck Podcast, which is part of the Kellogg's Writers Series. Today, we have the amazing opportunity of talking with poet Aaron Ballou. Aaron Ballou is currently a professor at the University of Houston, where she is a part of the Creative Writing Program's faculty. She is the co-founder of VITA, a nonprofit organization that focuses on informing people about the gender imbalances and the lack of diversity that surrounds literature, and is the founder of Writers Resist, a resistance network that publishes creative expressions of resistance by diverse writers and artists from around the world. She is the author of 5 poetry collections, Infanta, winner of the National Poetry Series, One Above and One Below, winner of the Midland Authors and Ohioana Poetry Prizes, Black Box, Slant Six, and Come Hither, Honeycomb. Her poems have also appeared in magazines like The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, Slate, Plowshares, Kenyon Review, and the American Poetry Review. Ballou's most recent poetry collection, Come Hither, Honeycomb, pulls readers in with her exploration of human vulnerability using her wit through her intellectually challenging poems. She constantly brings out how people can trap themselves in expectations of both themselves and others. She also utilizes different forms in her poems to provoke the readers to dig deeper to understand the messages she's trying to convey. Ballou forces the readers to pause and absorb the information at hand while contemplating how we, as humans, create these almost impossible situations and problems for ourselves. My name is Destiny Guidry, a senior literary studies major with a creative writing minor.
My name is Aliyah Hughes, and I'm an English graduate student.
My name is Ethan Thurston. I'm a senior creative writing major.
All right, Aaron, thank you so much for making time to meet us today.
Thank you for having me here.
It is our pleasure just to have this conversation with you. I hope you enjoy it. It's going to be pretty fun.
I can already tell it's going to be a good time.
Awesome. All right, so we're going to go ahead and get into the questions. So our first question, we just want to say we're in awe of you. Like, we really enjoyed talking about your poems and just, like, digging into it and everything. So we just want to, like, kind of go into that in a little bit. Right now we're just going to kind of talk about you as, like, an educator, because you're a mentor, an educator, an activist, an advocate, and you're a poet with 5 wonderful collections of poetry. You're honestly a force of nature.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So our first question is, when did this all start for you, and what keeps you going?
That's a good question. I think I was one of those kids who came to writing very young. I mean, you know, when you're in school and mm-hmm. everybody has sort of a thing that they're sort of their identity thing.
Yeah.
In some ways, my father was a public school administrator who was in charge of the special education and gifted programs mm-hmm. for my school system. And my father always had a lot. He was Wendell was a very groovy guy. And he was always like painting and writing. And he was a photographer. We had a dark room in our house. And when it became clear that I couldn't do math very early, I think it was like my father was like, you're a writer. Your writing is really good. And he was really, and having that parent or person, maybe it's not a parent, maybe it's just someone in your community, maybe it's a teacher, but just having that person who says, hey, you could really do this. Like, this is something you're really good at. I mean, the only other thing, I was also a serious jock when I was a kid. And I was a competitive springboard diver from the time I was like 4 all the way through college. And so, you know, and I grew up in Nebraska where everything is like, well, we'd like some sports with our sports, please. And so having someone there to just say, this is something special for you, was really meaningful to me. And I always try to remember this with my students, because sometimes, in fact, I just had a student I did with this with, sometimes you have to look at someone and say, hey, this is really good. Like, I don't know what you want to do with your life, but mm-hmm. like, this is something you could do. And she was just so blown away because no one had ever told her that. And so I think, yeah, so that was a long way of saying that I knew very early that this was kind of my thing, and I just never looked in any other direction, because, you know, you figure out pretty quickly, unless you go to the Olympics, there's not a lot of call for, you know, springboard mm-hmm. competitive divers after a certain age. It wasn't like I was going to be diving in my 50s. And so, yeah, it was a light that I followed, because I was very sort of single-minded about it. Mm-hmm. Against all odds, like, I grew up in the suburbs of Omaha, Nebraska. It wasn't like I grew up in like Manhattan in a loft or something. It wasn't like there was a clear line to follow, but I was just mm-hmm. like, well, I'm going to be this, and I'm going to will myself into making that happen. And it's probably a lot of it was just luck too.
That's awesome.
All right. So let's talk about your newest collection. The collection's title, Come Hither Honeycomb, sounds so sweet, yet many of the poems highlight the vulnerabilities and darker experiences of being human. We love the first poem, Instructions for the Hostage, and feel like this poem can resonate with anyone who has felt stuck in a situation without knowing how to escape it. And this villanelle, a line that gets repeated is, you must accept the door is never shut. And in the fourth stanza, you switch the is to was, signaling that the roles of captive and captor have changed, that you are now held captive by yourself. To us, it was a striking expression of how trauma can stick with us. Can you talk to us about how this poem came about?
Well, first of all, thank you for noticing that switch. I was really proud of that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no one's ever going to notice this. but you did. So thank you. Is this real talk? No one else is going to hear us except anyone who listens to the podcast, right? You know, I'd been through a really bad divorce where I knew that, you know, it was, you know, it's everyone's divorce is terrible in different ways. But this was very much like, you know, there was infidelity. There were secret credit cards that I didn't know had been taken out in my name. Like, it was as bad as it can be. Right. It was really bad. But I also, you know, my son was very much, you know, bonded to this person. And so I had spent years and years and years just like not getting out. And if anyone's listening to this, don't do this. You should go when it's time to go, right? Because I just didn't want to put my son through what I thought was going to be, and it turned out to be the best thing. But of course, I was just terrified that this was going to turn his world upside down, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just kept sticking it out and trying to make myself smaller and trying not to have, you know, trying not to create, you know, conflicts. And, you know, if you're in a relationship where you're just making yourself smaller and smaller and smaller, it's not a good sign, it turns out. I can tell you that now, right? And so after the fact of this whole fiery smash that happened in my life, you know, this was one of the first poems that I wrote sort of on the other side of that experience, and thinking about how we allow ourselves to be hostages sometimes for all kinds of, you know, fraught, you know, psychoanalytically, you know, like the unconscious self is like, I don't understand this about human beings. Like, why is it we see everything in hindsight? Yeah. Like, what is the biological advantage to our brains only showing us the truth of things after the fact? Like, mm-hmm. why did biology think that was a good idea? I don't understand that, because it doesn't seem to help. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was exactly what I was thinking about. And the other thing I will say about that poem is that I had waited many years. I'd always wanted to write a villanelle, but a villanelle is a very particular kind of form, and because it has all of those repetitions and rhymes in it, it doesn't work with just anything, right?
Yeah.
Those repeating lines have to be lines that are worth repeating,
yeah,
right? And they have to be kind of open enough to be like, more often than not with the great villanelles, they're kind of open and philosophical and meditative, but they also can't just be like mushy abstraction either, right? Mm-hmm. And it's hard to find something that you can repeat. As you know, those two lines repeat and then they come together at the end in that form. And then what was the first line? The first line came to me, you must accept the door is never shut. And it was one of those, like, I was just staring off into space in the patio and I was like, and then the next line just came into my head, but the hostage will remain no matter what. And then I was like, oh my God, I think these were this is the material for a villanelle. And so I'd been waiting like, I don't know, 25 years for the muses to like give me a couple lines to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons I always read that poem, because I'm just happy that the muses finally handed it over after much praying to them and sacrificing, right?
Yeah.
So there's a sentence that we adored from Pity the Doctor, Not the Disease, because of its content, but also because of its beautiful music. I raise my fin to him, celebrate the poison we're all swimming in, remembering the way you say cheers in Hungarian. Many of the poems in Come Hither Honeycomb feature internal rhymes. Can you describe your process of creating word music in your poetry?
You guys are this is like the greatest thing that has ever happened to me, because like people don't notice this stuff, or at least if they do, they don't talk to you about it. And it's just so cheering to see that you've noticed this. So thank you very much. I think one of the things that I've always really strongly believed, and I try to teach my MFA and PhD students, is there's a whole long answer here that has to do with modernism and our focus on image and the cinematic age that modernism sort of came about in. And we tend to be, especially in our culture at this point in history, we're hyper-visual, right? We're very focused on the idea of image and the idea of the cinematic. But one of the things I've never been willing to give up for poetry, which I know is one of the most profound pleasures of poetry that's been true for, you know, several thousand years, is the music of poetry, right? And sometimes, you know, Ezra Pound, and he was problematic in a lot of ways, but he was very smart about poetry in many ways. And he said, you know, we write to the music, not the metronome. So when people got rid of sort of the formal traditional receive form, I think sometimes people also, they threw the baby out with the bathwater a little bit, in that I find a lot of contemporary poetry doesn't account for the pleasure of rhythm and rhyme. But if you go outside of academia and you talk to people about their favorite poems, more often than not, they are rhyming in some way. And that's one of the things that has made poetry last for so long. It's like the way we can remember 10,000 pop songs,
mm-hmm.
right? Even ones we don't want to remember, we remember. We suddenly know all the words to them. And music and rhythm and rhyme bring that. It's not the only thing, but often they bring that memorable quality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever tried to memorize a poem that has no rhyme or rhythm? It's incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
My students sometimes, every once in a while, just to be incredibly cruel, I give them a memorization exercise, really because I want them to internalize those bodily rhythms and make them go past the conscious mind into the unconscious mind, so they're there when you reach for them. And memorizing a poem is a great way to make that happen. But sometimes they'll be like, well, do I have to do a rhyming poem? And I'm like, no, you can do whatever you want. And then they come back and they're like, oh my God, I can't memorize this. It's impossible, right? But when you think about, well, anyway, that's the answer to the question. I was about to go on like 45-minute lecture, but I stopped. So that's good.
Okay. All right. That's really awesome. I really like that, because it's like some of the things that we talk about in my poetry class right now too. So it's just really interesting just to hear other people talk about it.
Yeah.
So now,
plus, it's fun to rhyme. It's so much fun to rhyme. And people are like, oh, it's sing-songy. And it's like, well, it doesn't have to be. It can be very subtle. You can turn the volume up.
Yeah.
You can turn the volume down. There's lots of ways to do it.
And you might not know until you read it, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's my favorite time. It's just, you don't know.
Oh, I know. That's so great when it's so subtle that you're like, wait a minute. Like, you read it like 10 times before you realize that it rhymes.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, we do that all the time. It's just...
That's cool.
All right. So now another poem that we wanted to talk about a little bit is As for the Heart. As for the Heart, oh my gosh, ponders lastness. The last winter coat the speaker will ever buy, to renew or not to renew the magazine subscription. A heart that used to be unloved, now making the noise of an ancient radiator and cowboy boots tumbling in a dryer. Then we see the speaker's teenage son, so much like us, belly aching about his schoolwork, and the speaker not wanting or willing to tell him what's to come. And finally, our hearts are pierced by that single barbed weed growing amongst the flowers. And when the cold rain comes down, it's just too much. We needed to take a walk around the block after reading that.
Oh.
Not in a bad way. It's just like, you know. And we're left like, we're just left wondering like about the process of it and like everything that comes into it. So we want to know like, what was it like to organize those feelings and put them into like words like that? Like those different types of just, I don't know, opposites, I guess.
Man, these are really good questions. Well, I'll tell you, I'm a very reluctant writer, mm-hmm. and I often need someone to give me a prompt, or I need, because I'm always avoiding my feelings, to be perfectly honest. Like, I'm like, oh, I could do that, or I could watch Netflix, right? Yeah. Which won't make me feel weird and like the existential dread of the universe. So I have to like, but in this case, it was somebody, there's a Academy of American Poets has a program called Poem a Day that comes to people's mm-hmm. inboxes, and like 10 million people or see it or something. And somebody asked me if I had a poem for them for Poem a Day. And I was like, of course I do. I'll get it to you next week, but I just have to look through the many, many poems that I have. So I just remember, and I tend to write really early in the morning when I'm in a writing jag. And I just remember sitting on my porch at like 4 o'clock in the morning. I like writing when everybody else, like when the whole world is asleep. Mm. And I remember, and that was also this moment, because that's a fairly recent poem, and it was this moment where my son was getting ready to go off to college.
Mm-hmm.
And also I'm sure the whole, like, and this was all happening during the beginnings of COVID and everything, and so everything was feeling pretty mortal anyway. But I think that's a big moment for you in your life when your kid is like a bona fide adult that's going off to live without you. And it's like wonderful and glorious.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like, oh, I think I might be old. Like, did that happen? Because, you know, I think most people, if they're still kind of alive on the inside, you know, like I go around thinking I'm like 30 instead of like 57. Right. Because and then every once my birthday comes up and I'm like, what? How can I possibly be this old? Like, that's not me. That's a totally different person. And so I think I was sort of in that headspace anyway, thinking about like mortality and thinking about my own mortality. And I can't really remember that poem. Not all of my poems, like, as I said, with the Villanelle poem, mm-hmm. I had to wait around for many years for the muses to give me something. But that one came kind of on a relative scale, a little bit easier, right? And then there's those little bits of autobiography, which is that my son had just been like, you know, standing there slurping Bucatini while bitching about his AP psych class. And there's that moment, and I'm sorry to be a mom for a second, but like, there's a moment where sometimes your kid is doing a thing and you're sort of half listening to him and you're just looking at him like, what a wonderful human being you've turned out to be. What a beautiful creature you are. Right. And I hope he never hears this podcast because I'll make him like, oh my God, mom. But I mean, I was just sort of looking at him and just thinking, what a beautiful little being you are. And he's like, and that feeling, my heart kind of welled up for a second, just looking at him in that moment. Right. And that was one of those things that made it into the poem. I'm sure with your own poems, with your own stories or whatever, everybody kind of carries around things in their bank.
Mm-hmm.
Their image bank, or at least writers do, right? And that was one that was, you know, recently put into the image bank. And so that's how that one came out. And I had just bought a new coat. right. So you take the materials that are in front of you and just play with them until your heart and mind tell you why you're talking about this in the first place, mm-hmm. as opposed to like, I'm going to write a poem about mortality, right? It's just playing until the figures start to emerge from the words. Mm-hmm. Is that how it is for you guys? You're all like,
I personally just actually started writing poetry for a class because I'm not a poetry person. Like, I don't like writing it. So I'm just getting there, and I'm seeing like all these things, and they're like going in there. I'm like, I don't remember this, and it's from years ago.
Right. Yeah. And it's just like, yeah, I always think you have to trust your unconscious self, mm-hmm. is where the interesting stuff is usually lurking around, and sometimes pushing language around on a page for a while just allows that to emerge as like, it sounds very Yoda-like trying to explain. It's like, you're not actually in charge of the poem. The poem is in charge of you. Mm-hmm. And you're just kind of there to like bring it onto the page, as opposed to, I was just talking to the poet Dana Levin about this because she was just staying with me while she was visiting Houston. And she was talking to my students about this, this idea of like, you're there to like receive, right? And let whatever is going to come in her image. It's like the muses or whatever. For me, it's a very psychoanalytic process of just getting out, letting the ego get out of the way and letting something more interesting happen, because the interesting parts of us aren't usually about our egos.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of our peers pointed out that the collection begins with a body that's held hostage and then it ends with a body that's free, and felt that the middle was working in tension between those points. And then another peer was excited by the variety of poems in this collection, saying that they felt each poem was like an entirely new book. How did you go about choosing which poems would go into this collection and deciding what order to put them in?
You've busted me on a couple of counts here. I'm one of those writers where it has to be sort of dragged out of me. And I mean, to be fair, I'm also like a single mom with a full-time job, with actually two full-time jobs. And so it's sometimes harder at this point in life to find the space to just sit and work. But part of it too is that I find it uncomfortable. And so all the poems that are in that book, and the other thing I should say is that I never give up on a poem. I don't have like messy drafts that I just abandon. Like once I start a poem, I work it and work it and work it and work it and work it. And it might take a couple of days. It might take a couple of years, but I will not give up, once I finally started. And so everything that I had written in like 5 years went into that book, right? That was the whole thing. And I have never actually ordered one of my own books because, it's not that I wouldn't have opinions about it, but I think for me, and this is true for a lot of writers, where you need to count on your trusted readers to help you get enough perspective on the book to see where the echoes are and where the call and response is. Because when you're standing inside of it, you can't actually see the landscape. But I've spent lots of time helping friends order their books because you just can't see it as clearly as somebody else. Like someone will be like, I didn't realize until you just told me that the book opens with someone like physically hostage and somebody setting themselves free physically. Mm-hmm. Didn't know that until you told me. And then I'm like, wow, I'm brilliant. With my first book, I remember someone saying to me, I remember this sensation so clearly with my book Infanta. They're like, do you realize there's an animal or a small child in every one of your poems? And I was like, what? There is? I didn't know. I guess I just didn't know.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely interesting how some of those parts of yourselves kind of like leak into your poetry without realizing it. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, yeah, I didn't want to put that in there, but it's out there now.
Oops. Yep. Guess I'm telling people about that.
Mm-hmm. We've got to ask about the collection's back cover. We thought that it was an awesome choice to have an excerpt from a poem on the back cover instead of having a reviewer tell us what they think about your poetry. Was this your choice? And what are your thoughts on having an excerpt from the book on the book's cover versus excerpts from reviewers?
That is a really good question that no one has ever asked me. And I'll tell you, so blurbs, right? The things that are usually on the backs of books are mm-hmm. called blurbs. And here is something that is true in the writing world. Almost to a person, although there are probably a few exceptions, everyone hates writing them, mm-hmm. and everyone hates asking people for them. And it is a thing how people torture each other. And you do it. Like, I just wrote a blurb for someone the other day because it's like, well, it was done for me, and you want to, you know, and you want to help this person, and you want people, the book to get into people's hands, but it's just marketing and we all hate it. Because it's so hard to say anything in a blurb that doesn't just sound like, I mean, in fact, people do like impersonations of blurbs, you know, by turns, this and that, you know, lyric, but blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you always, it's just a bunch of cliches. And basically it's just like, who could you get to co-sign your book, mm-hmm. right? Like, which famous people can you get to co-sign your book for marketing? And I get marketing people need that kind of stuff. But one of the things I love about my press, Copper Canyon, is at some point they were like, we don't even know if blurbs are doing it that much good. And like sometimes, like in other books, they'll have, you know, a couple things from reviewers. I think this might be my first book that doesn't have blurbs. But after my first book, I was like, if you want blurbs, I'm not asking for them. Like, you go get your blurbs. That's not true. I asked Cheryl Strayed for a blurb because she's a friend and I thought it would sell a lot of books. But other than that, I wouldn't ask for any more blurbs after that, because it's just like, you know, it's terrible to have to ask people for things, and you know what it feels like. And anyway, it's terrible and it should stop. The practice should be stopped. Do you know what they're doing now? This is in the fiction world. Mm-hmm. They're asking people for pre-blurbs. They want people to blurb things that agents are sending out for presses to consider. So there's this horrible thing called I don't know if it's called a pre-blurb, but it's like, we want you to blurb it before we decide if we're going to take it or not. And man, people hate that with the fire of 10,000 suns. It's horrible.
Oh my God.
And all my fiction writer friends are expected to collect these as their agents send their books out, which is why everybody should be a poet. Yeah. Poets don't have to do that, but God, it's horrible. Can you imagine that?
That's,
it's like
insane.
And we may or may not take this book, but it's, yeah, just how much. And it's also a little bit like the activist in me is coming it out. It also is about privileging people who have access, mm-hmm. right, as opposed to people who don't have, you know, Stephen King or whomever to do this, right? It's like, what kind of access do you have? What kind of clout do you have? And I don't think that's how art should get made, probably. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Random House and Penguin did not ask my opinion about that. So if you want to call me, Random House, you can.
That's crazy. I didn't know about that. I didn't know, like...
Isn't it horrible?
It's horrible, yeah. I didn't know that, like, big of a... I figured they had to be, like, some kind of a pain anyways, because it's just, like, short little things. I just didn't know how, like... annoying they were.
You do it to be a good citizen. You do it to help out younger writers. You know, you do it because mm-hmm. somebody was kind to you, but it's not fun.
Yeah.
Super not fun.
Yeah.
But it's also not digging ditches. So let's keep our struggles in perspective, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I had to write a blurb.
All right. So straying a little bit from the blurbs. This might be like kind of an impossible question to answer, but I feel like you like, you'll be able to answer because you've been answering things like really well and really nice, and I really like your answers.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So your voice is honest, bold, witty, and humorous, like through all your poems and just like as you're talking to us right now. So how can aspiring writers bring a sense of vulnerability and playful language together, like mash it together to make it sound right and not like, I don't know, rude or anything like that, or like come off wrong?
Well, I think some people are sort of born with this like proclivity for the music and the pleasure and the playfulness of language. And then I think some people can work on it. Do you know what I mean? Maybe you have other gifts, but that's not the thing that first brought you to writing. If you wanted to get better at that, you might just start collecting words that you love. Like, just start keeping a notebook or going through, like, sometimes I'm such a nerd. I don't do as much as I used to, but, like, I would go through the OED and look up words and then look up, like, their derivations throughout history and the first time the word was ever used and what was that original. Like, if you don't come to it naturally, you might want to put it into practice, because whether you're a fiction writer or a poet, having all of that, it's just like having different crayons. You're like... Remember when you were a kid and you'd get the whole crayon box with all the colors in it. Mm-hmm. And that was such an amazing moment to have every one of the colors. And that's what you're trying to do, is just have every one of the colors. You don't want the little small pack. And so, yeah, I would collect phrases. The other thing I would do is listen on YouTube to great British actors reading stuff. Because if that doesn't make you love language, I don't know what will. Like, you can just find them reading things, and it just makes you feel like, oh, language is paint and language is music. So that was the first part of your question. What was the second part?
The question was just, like, how can you bring, like, a sense of vulnerability and playful language together? Like, combine those two.
The vulnerability thing, again, this is going to sound so vague, but, I mean, you just have to have it's somewhere between a willingness and a compulsion.
Mm.
Like, I don't know why I've always felt the need to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And some people, and it's weird because I only really feel that way on the page. And I know some of my students and some of my friends have struggled with this, which is how can I reveal the truest self? But I think you have to be willing to do, you have to be brave enough to do that, or compulsive enough to do that. Because as I tell my students all the time, the reader, even the dumbest reader, knows when you're lying, right? And poems don't have to be true in one way, but they do have to be emotionally and spiritually truthful.
Mm-hmm.
Because readers have an incredible BS detector. And if you're not willing to risk putting it out there, I think you just have to have this will to put your own weird, beautiful, freaky, unpleasant, embarrassing consciousness on the page, or you should probably do something more lucrative for a living.
I love that.
All right, so most of us are pretty new to poetry, especially me, and sometimes we're feeling a little lost, or like we aren't able to engage with poems as well as we'd like to. What general advice do you have for helping us and those us like us become better readers to poetry?
Well, the thing about a really good poem is that it doesn't usually, this isn't true all the time, but poems are like three-dimensional, right? And they don't necessarily give up all of their mysteries and all of their feelings and everything on a first read. I think one of my few virtues is that I don't mind when something makes me feel stupid. I know so many people who give up, we're like, I don't understand that. And it's like, well, read it again. So I don't mind not knowing things. Usually the poem has to also have enough appeal, right? It's kind of a bargain you make. Like, I'm not going to give up my mysteries immediately, but I am going to be appealing and interesting enough that you're going to want to stick around and find out, right? They're just like people, right? Like, you can meet someone who's really attractive, but you don't know everything about them immediately, right? Part of what's pleasurable is in that process is like getting to know them. And so I think just feeling confident that it's okay not to understand immediately, or the poems I still don't understand,
mm-hmm.
right? But that's okay. If they appeal, I'll just keep going back to them. So I just wish people wouldn't give up. Not everything's supposed to be easy, right? Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't be unpleasant, but not everything wants to give itself away immediately, I guess I would say.
Okay. In 2010, you co-founded VITA, a nonprofit intersectional feminist literary organization dedicated to creating transparency surrounding gender imbalances and the lack of diversity in the literary landscape. Can you tell us how this began, how VITA has grown after more than a decade of service, and where VITA is headed in the future?
Well, I'm not part of VITA anymore. We handed it over to another group of people who are doing other things with it now, because we gave 8 years to it as basically a full-time job on top of our full-time jobs. And honestly, at that point, the count, which we did for, so what VITA is best known for is doing something called the count. And the count was this very simple idea we had, which was, we both just said, well, what if we just simply counted a bunch of major magazines over the course of a year and try to get some numbers, because people were having opinions and stating things about the state of like women writing without anything like data. And of course we found out that the split was, you know, at best maybe 70-30, in a lot of places it was 80-20, in some places it was 90-10. And then the question becomes, well, why is that? Why are women not being represented? And then another thing we had to learn as part of our growing process as, you know, white women was, after that, we had asked the question about, like, okay, why are we separating this out into women? Why aren't we also including people of color, trans people, LGBTQ, you know? I mean, suddenly it was like, well, it's, we have to also look at this in other ways, because it's not just about, you know, women as this big monolithic block, right? And so we did the count, and it was a huge reaction. And over the next 5 years of doing the count, I think it really did help shift the landscape. I mean, it's the thing I'm proudest of. And we had this one idea that really served to kind of prick the whole thing open. And then it was like, psh! And it turned into a, it was a thing. It's quite a thing.
All right. So this is the part of the podcast where the gloves come off. And we're going to ask them.
Oh, wait, now?
Now? Yeah. Yeah.
Dang. All right.
We call it the lightning round. Are you ready, Aaron?
So I got to be lightning about it.
Yes.
Okay. I'm ready.
Okay.
What is your favorite swim stroke?
Butterfly.
Name one item in your home that you can't do without.
My wallpaper.
Oh. Corn chips or potato chips?
Potato chips.
Define your past year in 3 songs or less.
Can I use an album?
Sure.
Yeah.
Holes, Live Through This. Gorillaz, Clint Eastwood. And, oh, what's that Trixie Mattel song? The one, is it called Little Sister? I think it's Trixie Mattel's Little Sister.
Describe one of the best classes you've ever taught.
Oh, that's really hard because there's been so many good ones. But recently I've been teaching online for the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center has an online component called 24 Pearl Street. The students who come there are usually people who've wanted to write poetry their whole lives, but they've been off living a life and having a family and making money and all the stuff we have to do. And they come into that space with such like joy, and they're so excited to be there, and they're so awesome. And I just love doing that kind of teaching.
If you could go thrift shopping with any poet, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Frank O'Hara, because he would know all of the best places in Manhattan to go. And he would be a blast, and we would have cocktails and listen to good music. And he's like the funniest person on the planet, I think, at that time. Mm-hmm. So Frank O'Hara.
I love how fast you answered that. All right, Aaron, thank you so much for meeting with us today. It was really fun. We enjoyed like the conversation that we had with you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. All right, you can learn more about Aaron, her books on her website, aaronblue.com. And while you're at it, click over to your favorite independent bookstore and purchase a copy of Come Hither Honeycomb. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in. Good day, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the UND Potluck Podcast, hosted by students and faculty of the University of Indianapolis. We would like to thank our guests as well as the Shaheen College of Arts and Sciences. To learn more about the UND Potluck Podcast and hear other episodes, please visit etchings.und.edu. Thank you for your support of UND students and the arts.